Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with LS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert, and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, after years in the doldrums, have we finally got a proper ISA battle on our hands this year? We talk about the 95% interest-only mortgage, a victory for Virgin Money customers, and the threats of fines to help the environment that appear to be just that, threats. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.
Now, Lee, Simon, I remember the excitement of ISA season. We've been doing this podcast for quite a few years now, and ruddy-faced you'd come in, Lee, with the thrill of this time of year. But it's been quiet of late, I think that's fair enough to say. But less than 24 hours after Santander announced its new 1.5% easy access cash ISA, Coventry Building Society upped the ante with its own version, and it's open to everyone. So will others follow suit? And Lee, is ISA season back? Your cheeks are looking a bit rouge, so maybe.
ISA baby. Well, look, these are some signs, Georgie, that we've actually finally got a mini battle on our hands. And whether that means in the next few weeks that we see more providers slowly come back into the tax-free market remains to be seen. Now, the reason why I've got excited about this, let's take us back on a little history, back in time. Between March and May every year, banks, building societies, they used to scramble over each other to get the best buy rates out there for savers as people look to fill their pots before the April 5th tax deadline, and when the new tax year began, to try and entice savers in to start early and put money in early.
What was the appeal?
An easy way to get a big tranche of cash, and then it makes it quite easy for a bank and building society to see how much they're pulling in and knowing what they can then do with it over the course of over the year. And it was just essentially when a lot of people take an active interest in their cash ISA. So, you know, when they're really looking and hunting for those best deals. Now, in the last couple of years, that has sort of dissipated, really. We don't really see much of what we dubbed the cash ISA season. Bit of a personal finance term there, but it just hasn't happened. One of the big reasons why was the funding for lending scheme, which pumped cheap money into banks, so they haven't really needed to entice savers in. We've had decade of low Bank of England interest rates. You know, let's not forget that, you know, been 0.5% or 0.25%. And also the appetite, actually consumer appetite for especially cash ISAs has waned somewhat in the last few years. The personal savings allowance that came out in April 2016, which lets basic rate taxpayers earn £1,000 worth of interest before being taxed, and higher rate taxpayers £500, has kind of, it's made people feel like they don't particularly need to put their money away into a tax-free account. But of course, the more you build up that pot, the more likely you are to go over those thresholds. So it still is a worthwhile product to have. A lot of people also have turned their attention to other ISA products. The government loves an ISA, as we know. Stocks and shares have become more popular, stocks and shares ISAs. As people look to chase higher returns, fed up with low returns that they get via the cash ISAs. And the lifetime ISA has been fairly popular. You know, we've berated it a little bit on this podcast past, but people are using it. We had stats out this week from Skipton Building Society, who said last year something like 3,500 first-time buyers actually used the lifetime ISA last year to actually buy a house. So,
which is interesting, because just jumping in there, but you did say we've berated this on the show, been in the press. It's been criticised quite a lot, and one of the problems is there's just not a lot of providers out there. Is that still the case?
It's still the case. There's only a couple of providers out there, and also the reason why we've been a little bit critical of that whole product is the whole cloudiness of whether or not people should be confusing saving for a house and saving for the pension, two completely different goals. But as we do keep pointing out, that if you are definitely looking to buy a house in the next couple of years, it's well worth it, because a 25% return on your cash is not to be sniffed at whatsoever. So what that means is that the competition hasn't really been that strong. It's been a perfect storm, I would say, that's kind of made the ISA season disappear. So the reason why we've got a little bit excited about this Santander launch is that basically big high street banks have completely neglected savings altogether, not just the tax-free versions. But we've seen a little chink of light and a little bit more appetite from the big banks this year, actually coming in a little bit, dipping their toe, I would say, into a little bit of looking to get savings cash. A lot of that will be, we could see this trend continue because of the funding for lender scheme being wound down and not having access to that cheap cash. And all of a sudden, hey, we need to be bringing in money somehow. that might be from savers, you know, the steady savers that will come in, and you know exactly what you need to pay them and exactly how much you need to bring in. So Santander have offered 1.5%. It's only for 1, 2, 3 customers or select customers. So this is not open to everyone, but there's a lot of people out there that have Santander accounts. I would suggest it's, you know, well into the millions. The 1, 2, 3 current account, which is not as attractive as it once was, there's still a lot of people that have that account who can benefit from this better ISA. And then it just shows you straight away what happens when competition comes out like that. Coventry Builders Society, the second biggest mutual in Britain, brought out 1.5%. They were always active as well in the cash ISA season, a 1.5% account that's matched that. So that looks good. I mean, you say 1.5% and people might go, oh, 1.5%. I mean, that's so low. But let's not forget, last year, Marcus brought out 1.5% easy access rate, just a non-tax-free, you know, non-ISA account. People went mad for it, went absolutely crazy for it. Well, now you can get a cash ISA that matches that, and it's good signs, and we could see more of this happening. Santander have also launched a 2-year fixed rate ISA, which has gone near the top of our best buy tables at 1.9%. again, only open to those with 1, 2, 3 accounts or a select customers, but it could mean others may follow and we could see more competition.
Simon, cash ISAs, they worth it still?
I love a cash ISA, though.
Yeah.
I love a cash ISA.
As much as George Osborne loves just ISAs generally.
No, well, I think he's got I think he had a bit of an ISA fetish.
Okay,
to be honest,
right.
I don't think I would go that far.
No, you just
I think the preponderance of ISAs. I think the ISA system needs dramatic simplification, and I wrote about this some time ago. There are too many ISAs. I think also that the way the system is currently structured, where you can put money into lots of different kinds of ISAs. So you can have a stocks and shares ISA, you can have a cash ISA, you can have an innovative finance ISA, you can have a help to buy ISA, all of those things, but you can't have more than one of the same thing. So for example, where this crops up is you can't put new money into more than one cash ISA in the same year. Okay, so you can't put some money into a fixed rate cash ISA and some money into an easy access ISA. You've got a £20,000 ISA allowance. If you're only going to put your money into cash and you've got £20,000 to salt away, then actually it would make good financial sense to split that amongst a fixed rate for a better return and the easy access rate for money that you need to get to. If you are an investor, you can't put money into a Hargreaves Lansdown investing ISA, where you can pick your own shares, pick your own funds, pick your own investment trusts. I name them because they're the biggest company. But also decide that you're going to put some of your money into a stocks and shares ISA run by someone like Nutmeg, for example, who decide on your investments and manage your money for you. You can't decide to go with one of the companies because they're better for investing in funds and another company because they offer cheaper share dealing. There's no reason that it has to be like this. It could very simply be linked to your national insurance number, and you've got a £20,000 allowance. You use it however you want, as long as you stick below that £20,000. That's the important thing. And the reason why I say there's no reason why you shouldn't be allowed to do this is because you can have as many pensions as you want. This system already exists for self-invested personal pensions. Cash ISAs, though, are they still worth it? I think they are. And the reason why is because I think that it's highly unlikely that cash ISA tax-free system is ever going to be ripped off of people, because there would be absolute uproar. I think that there is a much greater chance that the personal savings allowance could be removed from people. I think that the people who are most at risk from this are higher rate taxpayers. That's anyone earning over about £43,000, £44,000 at the moment. That is due to go up. But lots of people will find themselves in that tax bracket. They can only get £500 worth of interest tax-free. That, if you can get a 2% rate on your savings, which is very possible nowadays, is £25,000 worth of savings. A lot of money, isn't it? But over a lifetime of saving, there'll be lots of people who build up more than £25,000 worth of savings. And one day, when you can earn 4% on your savings, which seems...
One day,
which seems crazy at the moment, doesn't it? But isn't actually that wild. If you look at history, one day, at some point... Maybe not in the near future, but maybe sometime into the future, you'll only be able to have £12,500 in savings. So I would say stash some money into a cash ISA. But I would say that if you're bumping into that £500 limit because you've already got £25,000 held in cash, maybe some of the money that you are saving on top of that should be going into investments, into an investing ISA. Because I think for pretty much anyone in the world, unless they need that money in the short term, i.e. for a house deposit or something, £25,000 is a pretty healthy cash buffer to have. And you should maybe be thinking about investing long term to get better returns.
Just a bit quick straw poll, because you were saying there about the simplification of the ISA system, there's too many. Just want to know, how many have we got in this studio? Simon?
ISAs?
Yeah.
Ooh, I've got a stocks and shares ISA.
Yes.
So that's my investment account. And I have a number of cash ISAs. And I am doing something.
We'll count that as one, shall we?
Well, yeah, but I've probably got about 4 cash ISAs in existence. And I'm going to point out something here, that I'm doing something that I tell people not to do. Most of those cash ISAs probably aren't earning as much money as they could be. They're old cash ISAs, maybe got like a bit of money in them, but not an insubstantial amount of money. And I haven't bothered to move them to the best rates. So what should I do? I should make sure that they all go into the best possible rate that I could get.
Excellent. So I'll give you 2 months to do that, Simon.
Yeah.
Remember when you didn't write your will for a very long time?
Yeah.
But you eventually
you know,
did
the
that.
Worst bit is one of them is with Virgin Money, because it used to be a Northern Rock account. And I could actually just move it to another cash ISA. I could just transfer it into their cash ISA that's better. And I haven't even done that.
Lee, what does that involve? Do you just phone them up and say, do you mind moving? Do you want to do it now, Simon? Do you want to get your phone out?
Just get them on the phone.
I know, exactly.
I think the problem was I phoned them up to try and find out what the rate was and how much money was in there. And then they said, you could do that. You just need to fill in a form. We'll send you the form, or you could do it online. I said, oh, I'll do it online. And then I never did it. Goes to show, should have got them to send me the form.
You should have done. Should have done. All right, so does that count as 5 then for Simon?
It's 2 different types of ISA.
I was going to go for 2 different
types. I haven't
types.
Bothered with an innovative finance ISA.
Okay, Lee.
And I wouldn't benefit from a help to buy one.
No.
Before I quickly answer this, you can sometimes do easy access and fixed rate ISAs, but not many providers offer them. They're called a mix and match ISA. So you can get a mix and match ISA. I think Charter Savings Bank are one of them that offers it. But there's not many that offer it, I just thought I'd point out.
And it relies on that same bank or building society offering decent rates on both products.
Exactly, yeah. So you're at the mercy of that. I've got 2. I've got a cash ISA that I've had for quite a while that I'm saving for me. And I've got a stocks and shares ISA that I've opened for my daughter. But stocks and shares ISA, that's just a stocks and shares ISA under my own allowance, not a junior ISA. Because if you've listened to this podcast past, I'd like to have control over what happens with that money once said daughter turns 18
beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yes, what about you, Georgie? How many have you got?
I've got 2. I've got a stocks and shares and a lifetime ISA. Mm. Throwing that one in the mix. Not a cash ISA, but I do have a Marcus.
Oh, well, there we go.
Simon looks at me like, ooh.
I don't have a lifetime ISA. I thought about opening a lifetime ISA because you can open them until you're 40. I can't open one now. I am now 40. But I decided not to bother because I already own a property.
Yeah.
So then I would be putting that money away and I wouldn't be able to get it until I'm 60. So it's actually more restrictive than putting money into my pension, and I get a better tax benefit from putting money into my pension. And I do as much as I can so that my employer gives me as much as they can. So I decided it wasn't worth having one.
So I don't have a house and I am still just under 40. It's the one product I don't think about. That makes me sound so sad. Kind of, why did I do it thinking? So it's like, shall I keep pushing into it?
You get 25% bonus.
If you don't own a property and you hope to one day own a property, then I think a lifetime ISA is a no-brainer.
Okay, so you've made me feel better about it. It's just because of all the things that people have been saying about it in the press as to, is this such a good idea? And because, like you said, that money is locked away until I'm sort of 60 if I don't use it to buy a house. So I've got a bit of a gap to fill between now and April. And it's like, do I put some of my savings in there? This is like financial advice for free. Come on, Simon. What do you reckon? What should I do?
I can understand your worry about locking up some of your money.
Mm.
I can understand your desire to balance some of it. I reckon chances are that you'll end up buying a property at some point in your life. And so you should seriously consider the fact that you're not going to find that kind of uplift on the money that you are saving anywhere else apart from a pension. And you can't get that until you are a pensioner. Whereas with the lifetime ISA, if you buy a property, it'll go towards the property.
Fabulous. Decision made. Right, now let's move our attention to something a little bit different, although we're still going to be sticking with savings. Because if you've been on the tube recently, you don't have to live in London to be in the tube. And actually, these adverts may be around elsewhere. Do let us know if they are. But you may have spotted a bright yellow ad offering 5% return on savings. Now, a new app-based fintech firm, Dozens, is behind it, but all may not be quite as straightforward as that. But lads, explain to me, what is this advert saying? What's the issue here?
Well, on our way back from recording this podcast last week, we spotted an advert on the tube that was quite eye-catching because it's bright yellow for a start.
Right, yeah.
And it says, are your savings keeping up with your lunch? There's a good chance your savings are not keeping up with rising prices. For example, food prices are going up at the rate of 3%, while the best interest rate banks currently offer is 2%. Dozens is on a mission to make sure your hard-earned savings are not losing value. So we've created 5% per annum fixed interest bonds. They start at just £100, are ISA eligible, and the interest is paid monthly. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So we were like, hang on a minute, what's this thing offering 5%? So we did some digging into it. Now, I have some slight concerns over the advert itself, because I think that this advert, and I think that I would not only criticise Dozens here. I think that this is something that's going on regularly with some of the new fintech firms. I think this advert is talking to people in the language, the traditional language of savings.
Mm-hmm.
What people understand from the traditional language of savings is a savings account. A savings account is protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme up to £85,000. But this is actually an investment.
Right.
And what Dozens is doing is quite unusual. Effectively, you are buying bonds. So you are actually lending money to Dozens itself. You are buying a bond. You're making an investment in that company. But it says that it has created what it describes as an almost risk-free,
almost
risk-free scenario that almost replicates a savings account, because Dozens takes that money from issuing the bonds and then it places all of that money into a separate ring-fenced account, trustee account, so it's controlled by a trustee, and then it also pays in the 5% interest that it owes on those bonds, and so it can't get at that money. Now, there's a couple of questions to my mind, which I think is why I have some concerns over the savings versus investing thing kind of here, is as the everyday person riding on the tube, how able are you to ascertain how risky this is? How able are you to work out whether Dozens, when it says it's put this into this trustee-based account and plus the 5% interest, how able are you to work out quite how safe that is, how well that ring fencing works, whether it will fall down, what the chances are of, if Dozens does go bust, the administrators not being able to get at that money? We have had scenarios recently. There was a high profile one with a small stockbroker that went bust, where people thought that their money in the nominee accounts should have been ring fenced, and the administrators tried to go after that money. And then, if you're not perfectly able to ascertain that, are you then able to work out the risk reward ratio? I.e., 5% sounds pretty good compared to the language of savings in the advert. But actually, is it enough? Is this actually, you're investing in a small fintech firm that says it's doing something very unusual with your money, and so you should be asking for a higher rate of return? And we did some digging. Some of that information was out there. We had to do quite a lot of digging to find some of it. Some of it we found in the bond prospectus itself, which a normal person would find very difficult to work their way through. I spoke to the founder yesterday. He tried to allay some of the concerns that we had over this. He was very open and very honest about it. He says that you can't invest without going through the T's and C's on the app. I still have a few concerns about it. It's very unusual. The 5% is apparently coming from the investors in Dozens and Project Imagine, which is Dozens' parents' company itself. So effectively, it's venture capital money that's then being used to pay the 5% interest that's going into this account. So actually, the great question is, why would you do this? Well, effectively, it's a bit of a loss leader. It's to pull customers in. So what they want to do is attract lots of customers in by offering them this, what they claim is this almost risk-free guaranteed rate of return. And it's going to cost them money. So if you're getting 5% return, well, say someone invests £10,000, that'll cost them 50 quid. well, actually, a customer acquisition cost of 50 quid isn't that bad for an investment firm that then thinks they can hopefully go on to have a long-term relationship and sell these people other things and make some profit from them in the end. But as I said, I just don't know how well equipped the normal person is to work out whether this is okay. And there is a golden rule in the world of investing, which is don't invest in things that you don't understand. I'm not entirely certain enough people can understand this compared to, you know, whether they would invest. Personally, I'd actually want a higher rate. I'd probably want 8 to 10% to justify the risk I was taking.
Interesting comments there, Simon. But I will stand in slight defence, I suppose, of, well, any company that advertises on the Tube, which is a financial company, because we've all been through T's and C's for anything we get, mobile contracts, everything. It cannot be oversimplified into an advert. So really, I mean, should there be like a health warning, like a cigarette packet on every advert saying, you know, please do double check? Because let's be honest, if you're going to be looking at that sort of advert, one would hope that you are a bit savvy, that you can look into more detail in these things. No?
Well, this is an advert aimed at savers for a start. It's not aimed at investors. And my argument would be that then it needs to have the word investment in here in the main print of the advert. So when it says we've created 5% per annum fixed interest bonds, it should say 5% per annum fixed interest investment bonds. Or when it says are ISA eligible, it should say stocks and shares ISA eligible. Okay. I think the problem is that people see, and I'm not just picking on dozens here, people see 5%, they see savings, they see interest, they see potentially mention of the word FCA or mention of the word FCS. They go, it's advertised on the Tube. It's ticked all these boxes. This must be safe. And what we were trying to get at with our article is just saying to people, if you do see something like this, do your digging properly before you put your money in. And if you can't work out exactly how this thing works, then maybe you shouldn't put your money in. Mm. And what we found unfortunate was we asked the FCA about this, and we specifically asked them about the advert. And we wanted to get their comments on it, whether they thought this advert was okay, whether they thought it wasn't okay, what is right or isn't right about it. The questions that we're talking about now, the FCA said they wouldn't comment on individual adverts.
Oh, great. Thank you very much for that information. I mean, there was an issue a couple of months back, wasn't there, Lee, about peer-to-peer lending being put in comparison site, website, savings tables.
Yeah, we've always had this argument, even at This Is Money, about where peer-to-peer should sit. I remember when it first started rearing its head, the whole peer-to-peer industry, I think Simon might have told me off a couple of times with putting stuff into our savings channel rather than an investment channel.
Well, we originally called it, we decided to coin the phrase lend to save, which we thought was better than peer-to-peer. But actually, we stopped using that, and the FCA didn't like people using that term because it took off a little bit because it said save, so it should have been lend to invest.
They shouldn't be included in savings tables. Simple as that, really. You know, they offer far.
Does it need to be more clarity? Is what I'm asking generally, rather than
there should. No, definitely, there does need to be more clarity. And actually, what we're noticing, especially this year, there's been a real boom in the innovative finance ISAs, for example. And some of those innovative finance ISAs are offering far more interest than what's on offer.
What are they?
Well, they're investing into different products. You know, they don't have the FSCS protection that a normal run-of-the-mill cash ISA has, so they're riskier. And whether or not the average person that, you know, invests in the ISA actually look at where this money's going and what's being done with it, and they do their due diligence, is another question. And I would argue that there's some established FISA providers out there that I would say, you know, nothing's ever completely safe, but they're reputable, they've been around for a long time, and you know that they're offering a good rate but not crazy rates. But then there's some out there that I look at and I'm just not convinced it's worth the risk. So as anyone and any product that you ever take out, you just need to take your time and do your research and have a look at what it is your money is actually being poured into, and just tread carefully. If something's offering 8-10% and a normal cash ISA is offering 1.5-2%, it's got to set off alarm bells.
And just one thing to add to this is, you know, the reason why that we're cautious on this and we want to flag these things to people is because on a daily basis, we get emails into our inbox from people who have put money into things that are part of this new fintech, exciting finance world. And they say, I thought, you know, it said it was guaranteed. There was the word guaranteed. I thought it was backed up. I thought it was safe. I thought it was secure. It said secure, it said guaranteed, and I've lost all my money. And they lose, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of pounds. And so our duty, we feel, to our readers is to raise these things and get them to question these things. And I don't think you will find many mainstream financial publications that have been more supportive of new finance and fintech than This Is Money. We are regularly writing about these things, flagging them to our readers, but just saying, go into it with your eyes open and know what you're doing.
Hear, hear, Simon.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little, give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
Now we have a victory for This Is Money. They care about their readers, as Simon just pointed out, and this is one instance where they fought on behalf of them. So Virgin Money have been forced to make a U-turn on refunding customers who were hit by interest charges. Now this is after they unwittingly only made minimum payments on their new Virgin Atlantic credit cards. Now, previously, the bank had said it made clear that those signing up for its new card would need to change their payment setting in order to avoid incurring interest. So, Lee, just tell us what happened.
I will, Georgie. I will point out that Virgin weren't forced. They kind of just made a U-turn off their own back. They weren't forced by anyone to do it.
I would like to think they were forced by the pressure of This Is Money.
I think it
was not like
be...
you went round and picketed outside their offices, yeah. Lee.
Get
I was trying
refunds.
To trying to say that the role of This Is Money in encouraging
it would
is
have
probably
helped.
Better.
Yeah? It would have helped. We encouraged them to make a U-turn. I don't think we could force a bank or a financial institution into doing something.
Really?
They chose to do it after some pressure from us and other publications.
Should I redo that whole bit then?
I think that's absolutely fine.
All right, great.
No,
thank you. Thank you, Lee.
That's fine. No, I think it adds a bit of flavour and colour to the podcast. So basically what happened in this circumstance is that some Virgin Atlantic credit card customers who'd been with them for a very long time, some of which had actually worked for Virgin Money since it first opened its doors. So they'd been part of the bank for a long time. They had these credit cards, no longer worked for them. And they, you know, like this card because you can earn points on it, which can convert into miles, which can be used for Virgin flights. Right, so if you ever get one of these cards, whether it's a Virgin one or whether it's an Avios one or any other kind of reward credit card, of course the rule, number one rule is, if you're going to do your everyday spending on it to get the points, you've got to make sure that you're paying off the full balance monthly. Otherwise the APRs on some of these cards are absolutely, you know, incredible. And that's how, you know, they look to make money to do this. We've spoken about this in the past. So what happened in this instance is that we had a number of people come forward saying that they had the Virgin Atlantic card. They were forced in this instance, Georgie, to reapply for their cards because they ditched MBNA as the provider. So they had to go through and get the new card. So this Virgin Atlantic Reward Plus card. What happened is that they'd set up direct debits paying a minimum amount rather than the full balance. And what that means is, if you're doing your everyday spending, so let's say you put a couple of £1,000 on it each month and you're only making a minimum payment, that means you're going to get charged interest on the rest of the balance that's not off the minimum payment. So that could be quite sizable. We had one reader get in touch who was £620 out of pocket from charges just in a couple of months from this. So you can see this person had been playing by the rules for a number of years, had to reapply for this card, and then didn't realise that it hadn't been set up for the full balance, and Virgin seemed to make it a little bit tricky. He argued, not very clear. They argued that it was in the terms and conditions. You know, we kind of written this story, and Virgin weren't willing to refund the number of customers we had. I think we had almost a dozen people get in touch. And then, sort of out of the blue, we got contacted by the reader, the one that lost £620, and he told us that last Friday Virgin had called him up out of the blue and said, we're going to refund the charges. So a little mini victory for us, a little mini victory for our readers. I mean, that's some sizable charges there. And I think the key thing to point out on this wasn't a new Virgin customer. This isn't someone that's just opened up this card and not looked at the terms and conditions and willy-nilly, you know, he played by the rules for all those years and all of a sudden he didn't know what he was doing and was getting charged. And, you know, it smacked of, you know, just a bit of lunacy and just do the right thing. Or offer some sort of balance, you know, £620 of interest is a lot of money. Go, well, look, you didn't sign up for these terms and conditions properly, but we can settle something. We can sort something out. But there's none of that. And I hate it. I hate it, George. You know, it's one of my bugbears when we've got to step in and ask a financial provider to try and do the right thing. I just think in that instance, I should have said, you either write it off or we come to some sort of agreement where you pay, you know, a little bit of the interest and then we go, you know, it's like they don't value the customers. That's what I hate. I hate that.
No, I agree with you. But also, I thought there were rules around I mean, I'm sure that they can sort of wheedle out of this and say, you know, it was very clear and we made it very clear. Look, people have fallen foul. And I imagine it's, you know, this is money readers are sensible people. So I imagine it's people who are pretty sensible falling foul of what should have been made really, really clear to people, but isn't. I mean, you're not going to write an article about just one person. I mean, you might do if it's an extreme situation. But this, I assume, was not an extreme situation. Quite a few people probably got caught out by this, which tells a story in and of itself, surely.
Exactly. And all those people that had been customers for a number of years. It was only because they ditched the credit card provider and they had to reapply for the cards that they fell into the trap.
Well, there you go. Well done. Now, turning our attention to small deposit mortgages, not necessarily a bad thing, despite their bad rep for the role in Britain's property boom of the noughties. But, Simon, you've put pen to paper over the 95% interest-only home starter mortgage from Newbury Building Society. So I'll let you explain why.
Yes. Now, this is an unusual mortgage. And what it does is offers you an interest-only mortgage for the first 3 years, and then you shift to a repayment mortgage after that. It's called the Home Starter Mortgage. The idea is it helps people get onto the housing ladder. They have lower payments to begin with because it's only interest only. They're not paying back any of the debt. And then it shifts to repayment. So it means it's not interest only for the whole life of the loan, but it's fixed for 3 years at a rate of 3.48%, after which it rises to the Building Society's standard variable rate, which is currently 4.45%. What that means in practice is that your monthly payments on a £150,000 mortgage would start off at £475. Mm-hmm. And then in 3 years' time, all being the same and the standard variable rate not having risen by then, would go up to £796. That's quite a big rise, and that's quite a lot of extra money to find. So why on earth would you offer a mortgage like this? Well, interestingly, what the Building Society does is it assesses the affordability of the mortgage, not on the lower payments now, but on the higher payments in the future. And that's presumably how they're able to offer this mortgage, because otherwise you'd think it would be completely crazy and you're just basically setting people up for a fall. So what arguably is going on here is that the people could pay more, mm-hmm. but they've got the choice to pay less, and you don't need to worry about there being a repayment vehicle in place because it will switch to a repayment mortgage. But it's a bit odd. And it sort of smacks of the kind of lending that was going on pre-2007. The innovation in the mortgage market, which was essentially because house prices were going up, money was cheap, and banks and building societies were lobbing it at home buyers and homeowners as quickly as they could in order to make lots of money. And so it led to things like the rise of widespread use of 100% mortgages, the 125% together mortgage from Northern Rock, where you not only borrowed the entire value of your property, but you topped that up with the 25% of the property on a personal loan. There are people who are now only just getting out of the sort of 125% element and into the point where they could actually get a normal mortgage on those properties. My concern is not necessarily over this mortgage, because Newbury says that actually this is a niche product, not that many people take it out. It's more, are we going to see more of this kind of stuff? Because the housing market has stalled a bit. Banks and building societies have got reasonable balance sheets. They've got money they'd like to lend out. And the reason why mortgage rates haven't risen as much as they could have done since the interest rate rise is because banks and building societies are kind of struggling to find people to lend the money to. And they're very keen to be making bigger profits, but at the moment, they're struggling to do so. And I think this just sounds a bit like those teaser rate mortgages that were talked about in the American subprime crisis, where you start off low and it suddenly shoots up. And the one thing I would say is over the next 3 years, there is a very plausible scenario where two things happen. One, interest rates go up, but two, house prices potentially fall. So you might find that your 95% interest-only mortgage, where you're not repaying back some of the debt, in 3 years' time, that you no longer have 5% equity in the property, which is going to make it very difficult for you to remortgage. And you are also then facing moving on to a standard variable rate from the Building Society that is no longer 4.45% and is actually perhaps 0.5% higher than that. And so it's not going to be £796. it's going to be more than that.
Just one thing on this, Simon. You say in your article that the property market is at a junction. What are you meaning by that?
I think we've pretty much reached the limit of what people can afford on current wages. Okay. And using the current mortgage rules that have come in since the mortgage market review, which was introduced after the financial crisis to try and crack down on some of the loose lending of the pre-financial crisis years. And I think that for banks and building societies, the more that people borrow, the more money that they make. So it's in their interest for house prices to keep going up or for the property market to be more active. And I think what we might see is we might see that you start to see a loosening of lending criteria because it's assessed on affordability at the moment. Can you afford those payments? That has led to longer and longer mortgages. We've talked about this before, the rise of the 30-year mortgage, then the 35-year mortgage. Some banks and building societies are offering 40-year terms. That's one way of bringing down payments. Another way of bringing down payments is doing a little bit of interest only and filtering that back in. And as long as you don't go all in interest only, you give some kind of repayment element, then you can fudge those costs down and you can maybe lend people a bit more money. And I don't think that that would be any good for anyone. But I suspect that what normally happens is before the property market takes a proper tumble, you have that one final leg up where you get that nice big bank. Everyone goes, yeah, it's all going to go up. It's different this time. Everything's fine. And I don't think we've seen that yet.
OK, let's turn our attention to something a little bit different though now, shall we? It's been pretty warm of late, but all drivers will know what it's like when a cold snap comes. I used to live in Newcastle. This happened all the time. You'd get up in the morning, windscreen is really icy, you need to get to work and need to get fast. And no matter how long you hang around, it just takes ages for your windscreen to de-ice. You might be tempted to leave the engine running to speed up the process, but as warnings from motoring groups and the like will tell you, you risk being fined. Now, there's a good reason behind that, I imagine, to help save the environment and all that. But This Is Money has found that despite being an offence, well, there's not actually much being done about it, certainly by the police, Lee. You're suggesting that they've got better things to do? I mean, I don't know. Lee, why were you looking into this? Because when I first read this story, I thought, What an interesting story. Like, why?
You did it, Georgie. You said this is a bit niche.
Well, 0.01% of drivers.
0.001.
Something like my bank savings account there. Have been fined. So, go on. What made you think of this?
We were interested about this for a number of reasons. Now, firstly, there's been a lot in the press in the last couple of years about warnings over you could get fined for, you know, leaving your engine running to de-ice your car, essentially. And I kept on thinking, there's no way that people are getting fined for this. There's just simply no way. So I walk from my house to the train station. It's about a 10-minute walk every morning. You're right, it's been a bit warmer in the last couple of weeks, but there's still been an overnight frost. Even when it was really, you know, 18, 20 degrees, it was very cold first thing in the morning. And I walk to work, to the station, and I will see at least half a dozen, usually more, cars sat on the driveway. Everyone's trying to leave at the same time, you know, rush hour. They've got their cars, you know, turned on, engines running. Sometimes people are in the car, sometimes they've just left it on the driveway running, which is a thieves' absolute dream, isn't it?
Yeah,
you
right.
Can just go and turn up and nick it. I saw someone the other week sitting on his driveway, and it was all iced up. He's got the windscreen wipers frantically going back and forth. What's that going to do? It's going to do absolutely nothing other than perhaps break your windscreen wipers. I don't understand it whatsoever. And also, earlier in the year, I saw a driver had literally chipped out a tiny bit of the ice from the front of their car. I'm talking like a letter-sized little viewing hole. Everything else was iced up all the way around the
car. Please tell me they didn't drive.
Driving along the road, it came to turn left down the road as I was walking the other side of the road and just mounted the curb and scraped the side of someone's wall because they couldn't see out the car properly.
Oh,
I just carried on driving on. You know, so it is an issue, Georgie.
Yeah.
Now, I know you're saying earlier to me that it was a bit niche, and it is a bit niche, but
I was just curious as to your reasoning behind exploring this a little bit further.
This is it. So we got one of our reporters, George Nixon, to do a Freedom of Information request to the police forces around Britain. And what we discovered, actually, is that there's been 500 fines in 4 years under what is known as Section 42 of the Road Traffic Act 1988, which is idling the engine, right? So that is hardly any. And that doesn't even mean necessarily that people were sitting there to defrost their cars. That might have been for other reasons. The other reason I was quite interested as well is that around Kensington and Chelsea, where the This Is Money HQ is based, a number of signs have gone up in the last year everywhere saying it is an offence to idle your engine in this area. Right, and you can risk a £40 fine.
Around London.
Well, no one's got anything to fear because, really, I mean, I say that, I mean, there is a possibility of getting fined, but it just feels like there's no real sort of policing of it. I mean, if they really wanted to, they could drive up and down this residential street that I walk down every day and they could fine people. And it could be a complete money making scheme. The other thing I will say about this as well, I had to drive to another train station a couple of weeks ago as a bus replacement from Southend to Liverpool Street every weekend until the end of time. And there was a load of coaches that were just idling in a queue outside with their engines running. Why are those engines running? We're talking about, we're in a time now where people are more environmentally conscious. I don't want to see people getting fined left, right and centre across the country. But surely some common sense applies in a situation like that in which you don't just sit there with your engine running.
Coaches are terrible for that. Now, I'm going to be a little bit cynical and say that the reason I think you're seeing a proliferation of signs going up, you will probably not see them outside of big cities. You'll probably see them in London. Budgets might be a little bit tight, and so I imagine that freedom of information request Simon's giving me the thumbs up will go up when you check it out next year or next year.
Yes, and the one thing I would add to this is that in London, it is the councils that are sending people out to do this. And at this point, I should introduce to the discussion an old friend of the podcast.
Do you know what? Islington Council.
Yeah, Islington Council.
I had a conversation with someone, I have to tell you this, the other day. I was looking around a flat and she started to slag off Islington Council. And I pointed her in the direction of our podcast past and said, there's a ton of them in which Simon has a go. And it's all about parking and all about driving and all
there
that
is
sort
a
of
number
thing. So you've got
of
a friend.
There is a number of things that Islington Council does well, okay? It our parks are very good.
Yep.
They are reasonably well looked after. Not as well as they were, but we can blame the government cuts for that. They're very good at rubbish and recycling. Not quite so good at keeping the streets clean in North Islington. Very good in South Islington, which is the posher bit by Upper Street. But hey-ho.
We're trying to keep it positive, Simon. Yeah,
exactly.
We can get to the negative bit in a minute.
But they have a real problem with cars and things like that because they're one of those councils that like to tell people what they should be doing. And I've lived in Islington for some time and I've had a Labour council and a Lib Dem council. I find it highly unlikely there will ever be a Conservative council. But it has a certain maternal or paternal attitude to telling people what they should be doing. And I'm going to read you something from Islington Council's website.
Okay.
20th of October 2016. Islington takes action on idling drivers as part of citywide sweep. Council reinforces its pioneering stance against engine idling to help combat 9,500 early deaths in the capital. Possibly a fact check scenario there where I don't think idling is causing 9,500 early deaths, but hey ho,
no, in the way of a good story, Simon.
No worry about conflating those two things. Islington's environment and transport chief took to the streets yesterday in the fight against unnecessary air pollution caused by drivers idling their engines. Councillor Claudia Webb joined a team of volunteer resident clean air champions, workers, and council staff at a vehicle idling action event, handing out information. Islington was the first London borough to enforce an anti-idling policy in 2014, informing and educating drivers. The council also has a team of compliance officers who enforce the policy and can fine drivers who persist in idling their engines. Now, do you know what? If you're sitting there by the side of the road with your engine running for no good reason, poisoning the air, then you definitely deserve to have a ticking off. You possibly deserve to be fined, although I wouldn't want to see people fined the first time, and they may have a good reason for leaving their engine running. But I think that if you're going to do this, you need to lead by example. And one of the other things Islington Council has is it has a number of little smart cars with cameras on the roofs, and they've got two people in them that drive them round, and they wait by the side of the road to catch people who are doing things they shouldn't be doing. Maybe they might be turning right at a point where there's only a left turn. In fact, there's a number of these. They do it on a number of roads by my house, between the station and my house. Now, I have one problem with this scenario, is whenever I walk past the people sitting in these Islington Council cars, invariably they are not only parked on a double yellow line, but you know what they've almost always got going on?
their car.
They're sat there
running.
With the engine running.
Have you taken down their?
Yes. So what I do
plate?
As I walk past is I go up to the window and I go tap 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 on the window, and they wind down the window and they look at me very suspiciously. And I go, "Could you turn the engine off, please?" And they look at me and go, "Huh?" I'm like, "Can you turn the engine off, please? You're not meant to be idling. You're polluting. That's
according
bad for the environment."
Section, yeah.
And about 50% of the time, they get a little bit defensive and argumentative. And I go, no, no, look, you've got to turn it off. The council fine people for this. And they don't look very happy when I do it.
Simon, take a photograph and send it to the council every time. Be one of those people, Simon. Yeah. Be one of
those people. I got a photo published in the local newspaper once of an Islington council car sat on double yellow lines fining people for parking.
Keep up the campaign, Simon. Keep up the campaign. Right, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you would like to contact us about any issue, or if you spot any council vehicles on double yellow lines keeping their engines running, please do get in contact.
Yes, tweet us at thisismoney. Email us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Support your local newspaper by sending photographs of those cars sat there idling on double yellow lines to the local newspaper. And come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can argue amongst yourselves in the comments.
Perfect. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.